Jojo, what's up, dude?
What's up? Good to see you.
For those of you who don't know, his real name is Joseph, but we call him Jojo here.
I always go by Jojo.
Right. Dude, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's funny, we're like longtime homie friends, and we've never actually chatted in person, but we chatted a bunch via that pitch, like in the Facebook group and everything before. So this is wonderful. How lovely.
I agree. This is awesome.
My pleasure, bro. Do I match what you thought my energy would be when we talk?
Yes, of course. I mean, I've seen enough videos of you that, like, I knew what I was getting myself into, which I'm totally cool with.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to this insane man at 11:30 a.m. We're going to talk some shit, talk about licensing, and take it from there. Well, anyways, thank you so much for doing this. You landed a placement you've landed before. You're great, dude. You're killing it. But I want to kind of, you know, shift the conversation to being all about me to being all about you. Firstly, where are you from? Like, let's go through your whole story. And like,
yeah,
you've been in that pitch for a little bit now. And oh no, I'm just so stoked to have you in the crew. But yeah, where are you from to start out with?
So I'm originally from Southern California. It's where I grew up. And I got married when I met my wife in college, also in Southern California. We got married pretty young and then moved to Phoenix, Arizona.
Phoenix is dope.
Yeah, we were there for about 5 years. It was a good time. And then after that, we moved up to Seattle, Washington, which is where I currently am. And I really love it here. Been here for just about 6 years. Actually, our six-year anniversary for moving to Seattle is in a couple days.
That's dope. I considered moving to Seattle back in the day. It was... Like, I think like early 2010s, me and a couple friends, I came back from New York. I was living in Charlotte. I'm still in Charlotte. I love it here. But for a little bit before Charlotte started blowing up and like having real artists come out and, you know, it's a really cool scene here now. At the time, it was just pretty dead. And I was like, oh, I gotta leave. And it was between like New York, Seattle, London, and I forgot where else, but Seattle's on one of the top picks, and it's fucking sick there. I got a lot of friends there. How's the scene?
It's good. You know, it's really interesting. Like, speaking personally, which kind of ties into like part of my journey in finding that pitch, when we moved to Seattle, like, I was already a fan of a lot of the music that came from there.
Sub pop
was more my jam. I kind of was like, I felt like I might have been a little too young to really appreciate the grunge scene. And so, like, you know, like, I appreciate Nirvana and Pearl Jam and like all those iconic Seattle bands from the 90s, but the bands I actually latched on to that was like a part of me growing up were like Fleet Foxes, Death Cab for Cutie, those kinds of bands. So like I was hard into Sub Pop, you know, really already into the Pacific Northwest music scene.
That's awesome.
But what was interesting is like when we moved up here, everything was cool. Like there's actually a really good appreciation for music up here where like people are actively going out to shows. People are like genuinely interested in what's happening in the arts scene. But it ended up, at least for me, like it was actually a little difficult trying to get connected into the scene as a musician.
You know what? One of my good friends, Brody, I was in a band with him. He is originally from Vancouver, but moved to Charlotte. We were in a bunch of bands when I first moved back here. And then he moved to Bellingham, which is you know, like an hour and a half or so. It's like smack dab
almost
between
the Canadian border.
Right. It's like between Vancouver and Seattle. And what is his band? He's really good. Oh my God, this is terrible. He's going to watch this. He's going to hate me. Oh my God. This is so, wait a second. This is terrible. Now, I'm not trying to push his music on your podcast, but give me 1 second. He's got, Well, it's just like, oh my God, this is, I'm in the worst. I'm going to find this by the, oh shit, dude. I'm going to find this by the end of it because his Instagram handle is the band name. Fuck. Brody, I know you're seeing this. I am a fan of your work and I feel terrible. Anyways, well, he felt like he couldn't really connect into the Seattle scene and they ended up moving to Seattle. And I think they're playing a lot more shows now, which is cool. But I do know that, like, I guess it's kind of harder to get into those circles. It's like kind of like a higher tier music industry town. It's not in New York or LA, but it's got a crew.
Well, it's really interesting because it's like there's there's definitely like the higher end, like nationally renowned music industry, but there's still right. like a huge subculture. Like Seattle's ethos has always been a little DIY, like lean a little toward punk yep. and grunge and stuff like that. But what's interesting is like there's this cultural thing that a lot of people who move here who aren't originally from here call the Seattle Freeze, which it's just like essentially like people here are really friendly. It just takes a really long time to like to develop a community. And yeah. I kind of found that in the music community too, which like, you know, it, within itself, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's more of a cultural thing. But like I kind of moved here with these expectations of like, all right, I'm just going to jump in. I'm going to get to know all these people. I'm going to start gigging. And it didn't happen as quickly as I thought it would, which the yeah. like the silver lining to that was I kind of pivoted for really the first time in my own music career to like focusing a little more on my own songwriting, getting more into yeah. recording, getting more into producing and engineering. Because like my job outside of music for a while now has been event production, and I got into that through being a live audio engineer.
Oh, so like, dope. I did live stuff too. You got yeah. balls, bro, because every time I would run live shows, I literally thought I was having a panic attack. Because like in the studio, if there's a problem with a cable, right. it's like, ah,
it's a controlled
shit.
Environment.
Yeah, it's whatever. But the worst thing, if you fuck up on a live, like there's a cable wrong and there's, you know, a thousand things that happen between you and the mic. Everybody, the whole crowd just looks at you and you're like, son of a bitch. That's why
when I first started doing live audio, I definitely went through that anxiety. And
I never left it.
Once I got over it, like, cause fortunately, like I was able to hit a stride at some point where like it turned into like, oh my God, can I do this? Like huge imposter syndrome too. All right, cool. I know I can do this. I kind of have a reputation. Now I'm just kind of learning and taking on the challenges. So honestly, like now there are definitely times when I get anxious. I always want things to go right. But yeah. when things go wrong, like I kind of have to laugh at it and just be like, well,
yeah,
you know, well, this is a live environment.
The thing is like you had imposter syndrome. You're like, can I really do this? My problem is I knew I couldn't do it, but I needed the gig and I technically knew my way around enough and I didn't want to be the real deal. That was my issue. I had absolutely no desire to be the real deal. I could like MD, like because before like production really took off, like I was primarily drumming and I would MD, so I'd have like my mm-hmm. Ableton rig. That was stressful enough because like I'm rocking a 2012 MacBook. It's dope, but it's also a 2012 MacBook, so right. like, you know, I didn't have like the crazy setup where mm-hmm. I forgot like churches, I saw their rig not too long ago and like they have like backups and backups and backups. So there's you probably know more than I, but like, okay. So like one of my buddies, he runs all the backing tracks for like Yeah Yeah Yeahs and a couple other like prominent stuff. I think he's worked with St. Lucia, but he has like, oh, it's my buddy Dustin's yeah. the drummer. One of my best friends, Dustin, you're probably listening to this too. Love you, Dustin. He's great. But there's like rigs like where it links with your laptop, I guess. And mm-hmm. like, I guess everything is built into there. So if your hard drive or something goes wrong, it's backed up and it continues like mm-hmm. with no error.
Yeah, essentially a server of its own.
Oh my God, dude. Yeah. I couldn't afford it at the time, but I mean, if I could have, maybe we wouldn't be talking. So I'm glad I couldn't afford it. So. But anyway, so you got into the lives, or you were doing like, yeah. a lot of live work.
So and then like you started picking I got into the live stuff a while ago, which honestly like made me appreciate music a lot more. As a musician, I'm a bass player. That's kind of like my nice. Cornerstone.
I'm a drummer. You know, that's why we're best friends. All
right,
cool.
Yeah, see, there you go. Like natural vibes right there.
Right.
But moving to Seattle, I started focusing more on like kind of developing my own sound as a singer-songwriter and an artist, but also just producing. You know, the funny thing about me is like I have appreciation for a lot of different genres. So like as a bass yeah. player, I play rock, I play funk. You know, as a singer-songwriter and a guitar player, I would play, you know, like folk or Americana or something. Right. So like right. I never felt like I fit into one genre. So like I'd kind of be working on my own stuff, which was more Americana, more folky and alt rock, but I would also like co-produce with a really good friend of mine and we would make like lo-fi beats and stuff, you know, like
hell yeah,
very,
dude.
Very different in style and genre. And like when I discovered that pitch, which I actually discovered you guys because I was for a while, I was part of a community called Indiepreneur, and you were on the podcast.
I love those guys.
Yeah,
I literally texted Kyle like circa this morning. Jack called me last week. I got to give him a call back. He's a great. I mean, they're both just solid humans. They really give a shit. I like them a lot.
Yeah, and so like you were being interviewed by Jack on their podcast, and I was listening to it. And I kid you not, like this, it was the first time that I heard somebody explain sync to me in a way that made sense. Because I knew it existed. I had other musician friends who did it, but it always felt like, you know, it was just this black hole. like make songs and like you load it somewhere and it just goes into the ether and like somehow it might end up on a commercial or a TV show or a movie or something, but the chances are really slim. But when I listened to your interview and you kind of broke down like, hey, like Microsync, and like the way that you were developing that pitch where you were like going to clients, getting exclusive contracts, coming back to the producer community. I'm like, oh, okay. That like that pipeline actually makes sense. And like if I made music and went that route, like I could see how it could go places. And at the time, you know, I was looking for opportunities to like take my music outside of just me making stuff for fun in my bedroom or like, you know, trying to organically like put music out there and hope somebody listens. Like I wanted music, even though like it hasn't always been my full-time career, it's never been just a hobby. Like it's a part of my life. It's a part of my identity. Like it's an art form that like,
and that is totally okay.
And seriously,
that is totally okay in itself. I think a lot of people, especially cause I'm like the loud douchebag who's like, oh, you know, you gotta make business. I don't give a shit like if people are full-time or not. The whole thing is life design. Like I'm a massive proponent of just designing the life that you want and building a business or something or just something around what promotes that lifestyle, you know? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, it doesn't make sense to be full-time in music. Absolutely not. But for a lot of people like part-time or just a little bit, that's what they need. But like having, you know, either a 9-to-5 or something different or like doing live sound or whatever. And then sync is, it's fine. Like there's identity too often gets in the way of music, unfortunately. And if you can kind of like move that to the side and just say like, hey, not even what makes me happy, but like what makes me feel fulfilled on my day to day.
Yeah.
You know, totally. That's it. And a lot of times it doesn't necessarily have to do with your work or whatever. Just do what feeds you internally, you know, and makes you not a complete piece of shit, you know?
Right. Yeah. And honestly, like that's one of the things that I appreciate about that pitch format is that it is like scalable on a personal level, you know, like there are seasons.
It's as much
where,
as you want out of it. It's as much as you want it.
Yeah, totally. And like I haven't landed a whole lot of placements in the 2 years that I've been with that pitch, but it's also because like, you know, I'm not doing things at the scale as some of the other producers in the group.
Right. And you don't like have to be necessarily either.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are seasons where I'm putting more into it. And then there are other seasons where just like things are happening with my job or things are happening in life or like maybe I didn't get maybe I didn't produce anything for a month, you know, or something like that.
Right.
But when I have sat down and like really knocked out a song that I've been jazzed about, like, I'd say more times than not, it's landed.
You'd be so surprised, like with back end payments, like royalties. It's funny, man. Like your catalog in general builds over time, but there's always going to be like if you go to a neighborhood, there's always going to be like one big ass house, you know, and that kind of makes the rest of, you know, the homes a little bit more expensive when they you know get put on Zillow. It's like, well, somebody bought this shit for $1 million, so you know your piece of crap with roaches everywhere, whatever. I'm saying this in confidence because I used to live in apartments with roaches, so I can say this.
Me too.
I didn't always have this beautiful light behind me, bro. Do you actually know what you want to know what this light says?
I think I posted it
in the group.
Yeah, I feel like it was in your other videos, but I don't remember what it is now. It
says, please don't do coke in the bathroom.
Yes.
But anyways, I'm kind of glad it's blurred out. But anyways, the whole thing is like, you know, regarding like kind of what we're talking about, it could be your life. It could be like how much you want to put in to whatever you're doing. Just kind of going back to what we were talking about, like, just make of it what you want. And like, royalties can build up randomly. Like, if one house kind of goes for a lot, like, I've seen people with their back end payments and they're like, yeah, like, I have a bunch of tracks that landed, but for some reason, this corner or this quarter, this one track nailed it. And like, mm-hmm. I brought in like $5,000 this quarter. And like, the mm-hmm. rest of the tracks weren't doing as crazy, but this track, you know, a couple quarters ago did fantastic. So you just never know. But that's the whole point. It's like, your songs are assets, you know, you can have a lot of fun with them creatively, and they can also help you monetarily. But it's like anything else. It's like, you can do as much as you want with it or as little as you want with it. It's just whatever you define as success, I'm 100% with it. The worst thing is when people make default goals. That's what I hate. Default mm-hmm. goals is, I want more. I want more of this. I want more money. I want more placements. I want whatever. It's like, that's such a not critically thought out goal. Cause like, mm-hmm. even like with that pitch, like, I don't want this to be absolutely massive. Like, it would, mm-hmm. it would suck, you know? Like, I like it being a crew. I like people being taken care of. I just want this to be the very best for the people who are part of it. And that's it, you know?
Yeah.
That's my goal. But it doesn't have to be more. It's just the very best for this crew, you know?
Right. It's essentially answering the why question, which is right. way more important than like, what can I do? More, why do I want to do it? And what's going to make me happy?
This has been a whole fucking experiment for me, dude. I literally was just like, is there a way where we can pay out 100% to people, make it more accessible, and it actually be economically a great situation for both sides? If I can do that and it breaks even every month, like, I feel like I've made the world a little bit better a place, like, you know. But anyways, so you started making a bunch of lo-fi, started making a bunch mm-hmm. of tracks and mm-hmm. kind of producing regularly, you know. How has kind of that been more in the studio lately? And speaking of goals, like, you seem like a very self-aware person. So what are kind of, you know, your ideas behind all of that? Do you plan on like getting more into the scene in Seattle? Like, what's everything, man? Are you happy where you're at, which is awesome.
Well, so to answer the first part of your question, being like in the quote unquote studio, because my studio is like this room.
Yeah, same
it's
here.
It's been fun. You know, like, I remember growing up there, you know, what was available to home studios was like Pro Tools, which was expensive and very fickle. And you had to have like the exact kind of OS and, dude, you know, any kind of plugins you wanted. Was just, everything felt very expensive. And the quality was hit or miss depending on what you were investing in. We're like, now technology is at a point where I can't believe what's available to me as a creator, not just like plugins and stuff. Like, I think UAD is like blowing my mind with
I got an 8P. That's what this mic is going into right now. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. It's just like, you got UAD, Valhalla, Soundtoys, like all these amazing plugin designers, right. plus all the MIDI instruments that are coming out. Like, I'm a huge fan of Spitfire and just
Spitfire's great.
The way that they create MIDI orchestras. It's just like, mm-hmm. literally any kind of instrument you can think of, whether it's real or not, it's available to us at a pretty reasonable price. And so to me as a creator, I've been waiting for years to have that opportunity to like, to be able to produce something that I can hear in my head and not have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to like be in a studio and like hire engineers and a bunch of musicians, which, like, don't get me wrong, I love all that stuff. Like, any opportunity I have to work with real musicians, like, I'm down. But as a like bedroom producer, it's pretty amazing the quality of stuff that we can create now just from our laptops and MIDI keyboards and stuff. So like, it's, I've been having a blast, like, being wearing that producer hat and being my own like session musician and being mixing engineer, like all this stuff. Like, well, I definitely enjoy the process.
Well, I grew up, I'm not sure your background, like, with, you know, studio work, but like, when I grew up, like, I was apprenticing, like interning sort of thing, just mm-hmm. like eating shit. And I worked at a number of different studios, and it was crazy. Cause like, you go to a new studio, you have to figure out the entire rig. You have to understand like how everything is hooked up. It was a total mm-hmm. pain in the ass, you know? And the first studio I had ever really walked in and like was actually like behind the board, it was a Radar system. Do you remember that at all?
No, I don't.
It was like, so like Pro Tools you can put on your computer, Ableton you can put on your computer. Radar was like its own machine. It was like, it was, it, I don't know if it's still around, but it was, you would hook it up with a board. So there was like an AMAC board. It had to be like, it was a big ass board. It was cool. It was like the first time I was in a studio and I was like, oh, like they had all the knobs, right? But I could not for the life of me. I was like scared to touch the machine. It just seemed terrifying. Luckily, I was primarily session drumming at the time. But like it was so complicated. It was so high friction and so expensive to do anything. And, you know, then I kind of moved over studios. I started working a little bit for this dude, Charles Holloman, who he actually has a studio in Muscle Shoals now, East Avalon Recorders.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's awesome dude. But he had a big ass studio complex here in Charlotte. It was just torn down for apartments. Fuck that. But like, ugh, it was a huge warehouse. Actually, that tape machine he gave me.
Oh, nice. Cool.
But, you know, he did... he was doing a lot of voiceover work and like commercial stuff. And I remember I was like, this is like when I learned who a producer was versus an engineer. Mm-hmm. So he would produce records. He worked with like Brandi Carlile, Anthony Hamilton, but where the real money was doing voiceover work and commercial stuff and like car commercials and jingles and shit. And he just had a lock on the Carolinas. And it was so funny because I was in the studio and we were in like Studio A. I was probably, maybe 17, 18, something. I was young, still in high school. And I remember he was working on, you know, the final edits. It's like the team would take care of like 90% of it. And like the last 10%, he would just do like those final, you know, things. And I remember he looks at me and he's like, listen, man, I know this looks boring as shit to you, but one day you're going to realize there's a shitload of money in this. And it's like so full circle because like here I am like 10 years later or whatever, 28. And I'm just like, you were right, Charles. Like, you know, it's just, it's so funny. But that's the thing. It's like commercial work, sync, you know, everybody looks at sync or publishing or whatever, and they look at it from a scope of like 20 years ago. And if you just look at it today, like, yeah, he was doing like commercial work for car commercials and jingles. That's what they would call it. But like now it's like in modern day, it's like, okay, it's all these little Facebook ads. It's like, I'm doing all this shit for Facebook ads and Instagram ads. And like, if I meet a marketing agency, we're going to do all of the work for all of their stuff. And like, I'm going to be the composer for this media company. I'm like their guy, you know, like everything is the same, but it just, the thing that people don't understand about the music industry is that there's always a shitload of money in it, but where it comes from changes every couple of years. And you have to be able to like look ahead and say, where is everything going? Like I'm on YouTube more than I am on watching Netflix even, you know, like a couple of years ago, I was like, there's going to be a time where YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, you know, all these companies start getting in real trouble for having, you know, music covers and all this stuff. YouTube was the first. They updated everything. So now you can't upload shit. It causes issues.
You get flagged really quick.
Yep. Facebook and Instagram are in the middle. They just negotiated a deal with the major labels. They're negotiating something with Merlin, which represents all independent music. And TikTok, I don't have the best hopes for TikTok, to be completely honest with you. But I do think it will eventually get updated. I don't think it's going to be a great deal from TikTok, but I also don't really believe in TikTok long-term either. Like, but that's like me saying, so, you know, whatever, DM me a death threat, whatever. Anyways, I
mean, you're kind of right about crypto at the moment.
Oh dude, I was screaming from the rooftops in the community. Don't fuck with NFTs. And everyone's like, well, it's going to add so much, man. Like it's changed everything. I'm like, it's great for you, but the buyers, what the fuck are they getting out of this? Nothing.
Right.
And lo and behold, buyers are like, hey, I don't think we're getting anything out of this. Anyways, love that. Well, listen, I want to listen to your track. Let's go over it. This was a holiday tune.
It was.
We're coming up on the holidays. Micro Sync is interesting. Like catalog stuff, everything, publishing, they do come in waves like throughout the year. But like what I've noticed is like it's becoming like there's like some predictable things, like holiday stuff will really start amping up in the second half of the year, you know. Like tropical music is needed come winter because cruise lines and vacation packages, whatever.
Yep.
Like, so it's like, hey, go somewhere hot, you know? But like, other than that, I think, you know, what you've probably realized is like, there's no genre limiting thing within Sync, at least through that pitch. Like, there's really nothing. Like, we've landed, dude, we've landed death metal.
Yeah. It really benefits to be a chameleon in Sync.
Yeah, just like make some tracks, have no ego in it, and just like pump some shit out and see what happens. Just build the catalog, build the neighborhood, you know?
Yeah. And this holiday tune is a great example of that, because like I don't make holiday tunes normally. I made a couple. These were actually tunes that I pitched for Holiday Briefs last year that got over and sat in the catalog for a year. And then I gave
I'm Jewish, so we only have dreidel. Like, that's it. It's everything's in minor.
Some klezmer, you know? Some holiday klezmer.
Yeah. I really so like.
Side note. Really quick side note. A couple years ago, doing a gig. I was doing an audio gig at this music venue that's known for bringing in jazz artists in Seattle, called the Royal Room. Really cool place. But I did a Hanukkah party where they brought in a bunch of like. No, it was sick. They brought in these Jewish artists who were like jazz combos, like modern jazz combos. So they took a lot of like traditional Jewish music and just like spiced it up. And everybody was like super into it. But it was so interesting because like, you know, I grew up like, you know, I grew up more on the Christian side of things. And sure, I was familiar with
whatever flavor you want. You're good with me, bro. Like, all good.
Well, the point that I was getting at is like, I was familiar with like the music that is associated with all of that and like hearing Christmas carols all jazzed up. And so like being in an environment where I wasn't familiar with the songs themselves, but I knew the interpolation part of it. It was like super interesting to me and I loved it. Like, it was awesome.
It's just cool. It's kind of like klezmer music is kind of like the way that I try to look at it. It's like the Jewish, traditional Eastern European, like Jewish version of like New Orleans second line.
Yeah. It's so sick.
It is so cool, man. Like like growing up, like even just, you know, like my bar mitzvah, like before, like there would be parties and like you would have these like crazy klezmer groups come in and it was nuts, man. Like, they can party. It's like going to a Snarky Puppy show. You know,
yeah,
it's like
totally.
Just the wildest, coolest jazz. Somehow one guy brings out electronics and, you know, everyone's drunk and you're like, oh my God. Like, it's awesome.
No, it is awesome. Okay. One last tangent. Cool. I don't know if you heard, but
all good, dude.
Wolfpack. I don't know if you're into Wolfpack.
Oh, I love Wolfpack. So good, dude. Their plugins. Projects. Amazing.
Oh yeah. The Wolf Compressor. I don't know it, but I know it. I know how it's
It's all awesome. Good. Yeah.
But they have a side project that they launched, I think it was this year, called Klezmer. You know,
what?
And it's like, yeah, go check it out. It's sick. It's klezmer music, but you know, Wolfpack style.
I'm gonna watch it. So they have one. What's the Flyers?
The Fearless Flyers.
Fearless Flyer. The drummer. What was the drummer? He was my buddy
Nate Smith.
Nate Smith. So when I went to Berkeley, my buddy Chris Hodge. This is a fun story. My buddy Chris Hodge. A student of Nate Smith, because he was like a assistant, like faculty member or whatever that year, and like. I studied a lot at Berkeley. Like, I cried every day in the practice rooms. That's just how it goes. Like, you go to Berkeley and you just have panic attacks and meltdowns in the practice room for 12 hours a day. And it's miserable and the best experience ever. Like, but that's why everyone drops out. It's like, all right, I'm going to join the industry now. But Chris Hodge, he studied under Nate Smith and it's probably the first or second semester. And oh my God, the shit that Nate would have him do, it would be like, I don't know. He had like weekly lessons or whatever it was. Right. I had like a crew of guys. It was my buddy, Daryl Ron, awesome acoustic guitarist, singer songwriter. Look him up. Daryl Ron. He's great. And he's done really, really well. Like, he got a deal with Secretly. So he has a publishing deal with them. Chris, I think works at Isotope now, maybe.
Oh, nice.
buddy drummer, and then our friend Matt Byron, who's a upright bassist in Nashville. And now he's like a lawyer, I think working with Warner or something. But that was like the crew. Chris was studying under Nate, and I just remember it was like maybe a Tuesday or Wednesday. And we were all going to hang out. And he's like, dude, I'm not going to be available this week. I was like, why? What's up? He's like, come to the practice room. I show up. He's like, I got to memorize this bullshit in 7 days. It was this long, that long. And like, I mean, when you go into Berkeley, like you have to test, like to make sure that they like give you
to just even get in.
Yeah. But once you're in, they have like a rating system, where the idea is like you enter as a rating 1 and you leave as an 8 over 8 semesters. And I think I'm like, when I first got in, I was like a 4. I think it was like 3.444 or something like that. Because there's like 4 different things. And he was around that level. He was badass. I think he got like 1.5 on like one of the 4 things. But we were both like the same. And I mean, this guy, it was just the most insane task ever. And he was probably just studying for like 15 hours a day, sleeping in the practice room. At a certain point, he was just like, fuck this. And he just showed up and he's like, I'm going to give him my best. What's he going to do? Expel me? All of our friends got caught with drugs. Like, they didn't get expelled. So anyways, that's my Nate Smith story. I never met him though, but seems like a total badass. Anyways, well, cool. Let's listen to your track. We'll chop it up a little bit more and then head out. All right, man?
Sounds good.
All right. So this track is called, it's a holiday track, but it is called
Holiday Hop.
Holiday Hop. Hell yeah, dude. All right, here we go. Here is Holiday Hop by our good friend, JoJo. Fuck yeah. Okay, so I want to break this down a little bit. I feel like the past couple of interviews I've had, I'm literally just like breaking down lo-fi, and I'm like, it's all the same. This is why it landed. Here's the, you're all doing the same thing, and that's why they're doing well. This is actually cool because Holiday is, you have to, you're kind of like dodging potential problems with Holiday. So a big thing is most people actually think that a lot of Holiday music is public domain. So, you know, there's a couple issues with that. Firstly, most Holiday music is not public domain. If you're not familiar, public domain means that, so I think it's like US, specifically US, I want to say it's 76 years or like 73 years, but I should know this offhand, but whatever. If there's a copyright owner of material, they own it for 70 something years. After that, it is considered in the public domain. So I believe if they don't renew it or like the, you know, no company acquires that material, but it might just actually be that like it's just gone. So if, you know, this could be books, it could be audio, whatever, but you can look up right now, public domain, like what's the cutoff year on Google. And basically any book, any piece of audio, anything that is older than that, you could reproduce and license or sell or whatever. And it's, you don't have to pay anybody. It's just considered old as shit. Who are you going to pay? Great grandpa? No. So that's the whole deal. So with Holiday music, a lot of like very, very popularized Holiday music, Merry Christmas, like that is, you know, not public domain. It's owned. So when companies want you to make Holiday music, 9 times out of 10, and if you listen to like any show or any YouTube channel where there's Holiday music in the background, they're not playing like Merry Christmas. They're not playing that because it is going to be very expensive because they have to actually license the publishing and the master rights, right? And if they want you to make a master of the track, they want you to make a recording, like your own recorded version, you have to license the publishing, which is basically like the design of the track, the composition, like just the, yeah, that's it. That's the blueprint. So the way that companies don't deal with that is they say, all right, we need Holiday themed, but it doesn't have to be a holiday song. And you did a fantastic job because holiday music, you know, at least Christmas music, let's keep it a Christmas because bro, all Hanukkah music is in minor. Let's not talk about that. but for Christmas music, it's usually pretty uplifting. And you kind of just, there's very, very simple motifs. Like even Merry Christmas, America, and Happy Holiday. Like it's very simple, and they just repeat that shit. So if you're not familiar with what a motif is, a motif is a very simple melody that is repeated throughout a song, and it appears in different places, and it kind of glues everything together. I'd say the master of motifs is Michael Angelakis by Passion Pit, of Passion Pit. If you listen to like any track, it's just like 10 different motifs that all somehow align and they come in at different points. So
you, it's like often that doubles as the hook too.
Exactly.
Like, so you can have a really good motif. It's also a really good hook.
Well, they're all hooks. I mean, yeah. Basically, yeah. You know, a hook, people usually think a hook is just the vocals, but I will tell you, and most singers will be very upset that I say this, but I'm being honest. Most people who sing back a song or hum back a song are humming back the motifs. That motifs can be vocals, but oftentimes it's the instrumentation. Mm-hmm. So like there's a track by Passion Pit. What the hell is the name of it? It's on Manners. Record Manners, but it's like ba da 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 ba da 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 ba da 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 ba da 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 da, and it just continues that, and then under it, there's a bass line that, and then there's like all these different things. Churches. And then there's like 10 other motifs that go over it. And that's what you sing back. So Christmas music, holiday music is just packed to the brim with motifs. And they work very well together. What you did phenomenally is when you brought in the horns, that's why you landed it. Because that was just very, very well. There's a number of reasons why you landed it, you know. But if you listen back to this track, just like scroll back and listen to it, he brings in the horns kind of, what would that be?
It was the first chorus. They first show up in the first chorus.
Okay. Yeah. Is that the very start or post chorus? I feel like it's a Q&A sort of thing.
It was at the very start of the first chorus. So like okay. intro verse when it was establishing everything mm-hmm. didn't have the horns. Then it came in on the first chorus.
Got it.
And it was kind of peppered in it, first chorus, and then that like interlude breakdown where it really highlighted the horns, and then it was like peppered through the second chorus. But it would like build more and more as a prominent feature. Which
yeah,
I think,
and
yeah,
that
I wanted the horns to be like the thing that was unique to the track.
Yeah, and it glued it very, very well together. So like aside from like all the things that you did stylistically from production, like you had the bells. You had like the tambourine, like that. Mm-hmm. There's certain things that are holiday music. For instance, like, you know, if you make Bollywood music, you're going to have a tabla in there. Like there's things that just, oh, I know what they're getting at here, you know? So you use those instrumentation, but, you know, more than just the instrumentation, I think that's a very obvious feature, but like digging into it, the arrangement was very well done. And just stemmed from those motifs. It was,
yeah,
that was great, man.
Thank
a lot
you.
Of people say it like glues it together, but like the thing that's amazing about arrangements, and you can do this through any production analysis, you can literally like take a track and you can write out, you know, the verse. Like what I would do constantly, just like studying like my favorite productions, is I would take a track, I would literally write down verse. And then I would say first half includes these things. And I would like label like these are the different motifs. Second half includes this. Oh, there was this arpeggiator that came in here. And then it almost becomes a system where you can realize like how songs are constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take the magic away. If anything, it makes the magic a lot more accessible. And it's really cool. And that's when people say a song is a conversation. You know, you had that. You had Q&As kind of going on. Like, you know, the bells would ask the question and then the horns would answer it, you know? And it's like they were talking to one another. And all of this is just a fantastic arrangement. I would strongly suggest anybody who, you know, wants to land holiday music, because again, there's a shitload of money in it. There's dudes and girls who all they do, like I know one guy, all he makes is Halloween music and doesn't make shit throughout the year, but November, he gets millions and millions of streams. He's the one person that, yeah. So like that's the thing is like, there's pretty like, it's kind of funny. Like, and I'm saying that you're probably, people listening are like, oh, that's like one example. There's a billion examples. Like you'd be, I'm talking to a company right now for that pitch to supply music to. All they do is just supply the overwhelming majority of fitness apps with their music. That's it. Fitness apps. There's meditation app companies that provide like ambient music. Like that it's, insane how big and particular these corners of the market are. So,
totally.
If you want to learn about arrangement in general, I would strongly suggest listening back to this track that JoJo produced and write down like intro, verse, you know, chorus, bridge, chorus, outro, and write down when these little motifs come in and out. It could be the main motif that was the bells. It could be when the sax and the trumpets or whatever horns you had in come in, and just really write it out. Because next time you have an arrangement, you don't have to feel it. You have a true understanding of how the industry works and how commercial success happens with music. And once you have that down, production, like once you understand those rules for arrangement, you can be a lot more sophisticated with it. So anyways, really well done, man. I wanted to dig into that a little bit because like, it's just very well done. Seriously.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And that one was a fun one too. Like I mentioned before, it's like, I don't normally do holiday music, but when the brief came last year in the wave of holiday briefs, I saw it and I'm like, oh, this sounds fun. Like I literally did it because it sounded fun. And something else that was kind of unique to this track, and I made one other that hasn't landed yet, but when I was making them, I kind of envisioned what the end goal might be, which I don't always do with sync music. But this one, I was like, oh, you know what? I want to make something that would land on, you know, like a Toyota commercial or a Honda-thon, Happy Honda Days commercial. And so like, that's I already had this idea.
Happy
of, like,
Hyundai Days.
Sound. Exactly. So like that, but like that gave me an idea of like what to aim for as far as like the kind of vibe I wanted, the kind of sound I wanted. I knew I wanted something that was like reminiscent of Mariah Carey, but not exactly, you know, all I want for Christmas is you. But
dude, happy Hanukkah.
Yeah.
But,
there you go.
Yeah, there we go. But I think, you know, a good thing that you did regarding kind of like removing your ego from it, like let's do something fun. Let's think about where this is going to be. Here's the thing is people who hear that for the first time and they don't know any better, and they're just like early on in music, they'll be like, oh, he's sold out. Like, he's just making music for money. Like, I don't know why that was a Southern accent, but it could be really any accent. I'm just in North Carolina, so it's like my go-to. It's my go-to if someone's angry at me. So like, it's fine. What's good to understand is like your entire music career, however you want to approach it, is up to you, right? But there are certain places where different value from that music needs to be derived. And you can choose to do that or not, right? But if, you know, you're thinking about someone who's going to buy this, who's the customer is, you need to think about them. And so every song that you make, when you are in the studio, and I approach this for everything. Like, I got to work on a record for Future and Lil Baby. They were like featured on one of Russian's tracks. And I didn't do that much on that record, because if I did, it would have sounded like me. This needed to sound like them. Like, I needed to work on, like, my buddy hit me up, Kevin McCloskey. He was like the main mix engineer. He's like, hey, these certain things need to be edited. These certain things need to be beefed up, right? And if I got my ego in the way and I was like, what do I think would be dope for me, right? Like, I don't listen much to Future Lil Baby. Like, I sound like such a piece of shit. But I just work on the records when I listen to it. But no, it's like, I listen to like indie pop, synth pop, and like, I've been really into grime and like Mickey Avalon and Dirt Nasty, if you know that. Like, I'm like really into that right now. I don't know. But, you know, I was just like, what does the audience need? And even Rick Rubin will say, like, he is not a producer. He is just the audience. He is saying what the audience wants to hear. So the same thing applies. When you make a track, the best thing to do is to set your intentions before you, is this track for me or is this track for them? And I guarantee you, you will be happier and you will make more money and you will feel more fulfilled if you set that precedent. But not every track has to be for you. And not every track should be for them. You do need stuff that feeds you. Like, if I only worked on music for others, I'd be miserable. Like, I like working on my own shit with my friends too. So you have to be able to differentiate. And I think you've done a fantastic job of that, man. And I'm very impressed with you. You're a badass. So that's it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate well, that.
So I have two questions that I ask before I end any episode. Mm-hmm. Firstly, what would you tell someone pursuing music right now? Best advice you can give them? Something that has helped you in life. And number two, where can people find you online? If you got any pluggables, where can people hit? And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as advice goes, I would say, one, like, we kind of thought what we already talked about when you're making music for sync, like, pay attention to your arrangement, because I think that is pretty crucial for having a song land. Like, if you have a strong arrangement that gets the, you know, quote unquote story across, like, people are going to pay attention to it, and also pay attention to the just the production of it in the mix. I know that we've discussed this a lot in the producer land group of like, how polished should our songs sound when we submit them? And like, I know every song that has landed for me, I've put a lot of effort into mixing it as if I was mixing it for a real record. And it just seems like whoever, like whatever music supervisors are listening to, that seems to matter to them. And this holiday song was a good example because, you know, it sat in the catalog for a year and then I refreshed the mix. Didn't do a whole lot, but I refreshed the mix and sure enough, like, it landed like the month that I re-uploaded it into the catalog. So that's pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And sometimes also, that's all it takes.
Note, yeah. No, totally. And like, yeah, it's also on that note, I was going to follow up. My second thing is, you know, just be patient and be hopeful. You know, with this holiday tune, it took over a year for it to land. And a lot of it, I feel like a lot of it had to do with just timing, like being the right type of song for the right time. Because last year, I think the ones that landed and the one that music supervisors were looking for were more earnest and more contemplative, where it's like my holiday song was on the fun and goofy and lighthearted end, which did make it like wrong or like not able to be landed. It just wasn't what they were looking for at the time. Yeah. But this time around, it worked. So like, yeah, like if you make a song that you're jazzed about and you think is a good fit, then stick with it, even if it might take a while for it to get picked up. So that would be mine. And then as far as where you can find me, I am on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. My handle on Instagram and YouTube is Jojo Nieves Official. The YouTube handle, because they just introduced like customized YouTube handles, which is awesome, is Jojo Nieves. And I also have a website, jojonieves.com. So yeah.
Amazing. Jojo, thank you so much for being on the That Pitch Podcast. And I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
We'll chop it up after this. I'm just going to stop the recording. But yeah, there we go. Have a great day. If this comes out around the holidays, have a great holiday. If it comes out after the holidays, hope you had a great holiday. And yeah, we'll end it here. All right. Thanks, bud.
Happy Hanukkah.